Welcome to Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. Our intention in bringing these programs to the community, we bring things that we think you're going to enjoy and that we think are exceptional. Today I have in the studio a medical professional, a doctor, who has a very interesting scope of practice and interesting way of showing up in community. I have Dr. Sean Dugan. He's the adult and pediatric forensic medical examiner, the director of forensic services at Shasta Community Health Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. That's a long title. you're a busy man.
I'm very busy.
One of the things I like to do is have the community get to know the person more than just what they're doing. So I'm wondering where you grew up.
So believe it or not, and I know I don't appear this, but I actually grew up in Hawaii.
Ah.
Yeah. I was born in California, and my folks moved back to their home, which is Hawaii, when I was two. And I was there pretty much until my late 20s.
Wow.
Except for, you know, going to college in Southern California.
Certainly. Yeah. Yes.
But came back to Hawaii.
Which island were you on?
Oahu.
Oahu. Wow. Yep. So where did you go to school?
So I actually
university.
I went first to the University of Southern California for my undergraduate. And then after I graduated, went back to the University of Hawaii. And that's where I did my medical education. And then I stayed with the program with the university and completed my pediatric residency. So in total, I was there for about 7 years, you know, completing my medical training.
Wow. Wow. Do you ever think about going back?
I do. But, oh, yeah. The cost of living is so high.
It is high, isn't it?
That's the reason I left. I wanted to have a comfortable home. I wanted some land. And I just knew I couldn't get that in Hawaii. I mean, unless I was a, you know, bajillionaire.
Yes.
And the starting pay for doctors in Hawaii is a lot lower. It's for some professions, it's half of what you make here on what we call the mainland.
Yes.
Which is the continental United States. And so I looked at job offers there, and it was not even
feasible.
It's just a non-starter. Yeah.
Wow.
What they would offer me for starting there, most of the nurses I work with here make way more than that. So.
Wow.
Yeah, it just wasn't a realistic thing. They call it the paradise tax yeah. because everybody wants to live in Hawaii, so they don't have to offer as much. And so, yeah, it just wasn't in the cards for me. But I do, you know, of course I miss it. I miss the food, the culture of my family.
Sure.
The warm weather. But I never got to grow up experiencing winter and fall, you know. And so, right, excuse me, when I moved here, you know, it was really my first fall and my first winter. And, you know, I'll never forget that, so.
How'd you end up in Reading?
So, one of the things about me is in my medical profession, I use my brain. I use my, you know, knowledge, experience, et cetera.
Training, all that good
all
stuff.
All that jazz, yeah. But when it comes to making kind of life decisions or, you know, whatever, I'm known for having a good gut. Like, I have a very good instinct. And I think most people actually do. It's just, you know, we're not really taught to follow our instincts or really harness that skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so, actually, going back to USC, I hadn't known much about the university, but I got this postcard in the mail. And it was a recruitment postcard. And I was kind of going through a bunch of them. I had a fat stack of them. And I remember my dad was in the living room, and I mentioned, oh, USC. And I was like, I don't know the school. I'm just going to toss it. And he's like, what? He's like, that's a really good school. You need to consider applying there. And lo and behold, I end up going there. Well, repeat in 2008, 2009. I get another postcard in the mail, and it's from a recruiter in Northern California. And to be honest with you, I didn't know much about Northern California mm-hmm. back then. I hadn't even heard of Reading. And again, my gut was just pinging strong. And so I ended up calling the recruiter, did an interview up here. And I remember being in the ICU during the last tail of my residency. And the attendings knew I was, you know, applying for jobs elsewhere in the state. So they were really chill. So they let me, you know, kind of go off and make a phone call. And so I make this phone call, and the recruiter's like, are you actually serious about this? Are you really serious about coming to Reading from Hawaii? And I said, yes, I am serious. And so I ended up coming here one time interviewing, and it felt right. Felt like this is the place I need to be. And so 2 weeks after residency, I moved to Reading and never looked back.
That's amazing. I also like your emphasis on paying attention to that gut response or intuition. And working with people in psychotherapy, that's what I'm always encouraging them. Because in our culture, there isn't really an encouragement to tune into that. We all have it. It's whether or not we tune in.
That's right.
Yes. And it is part of our guidance system. I would call it even our higher wisdom. It's not about a thinking process. It's about sensing. And it's very powerful. So I really appreciate you highlighting that.
Thank
it's
you.
A good thing to increase your skill with.
Yeah, I agree. I almost wish there was training on enhancing it. You know, I really think, and I think in other cultures there probably is more emphasis on it.
Yes.
And it not just in making life decisions, it'll keep you out of trouble. You know, your gut, it's a powerful thing, the intuition.
Yes.
And I agree with you. I think it's not taught enough and not harnessed enough.
Yes.
Hopefully, maybe that'll be a change someday.
Yes. I would love to see that imbalancing bank account, you know, life skills.
Yeah.
And I do think intuition and tuning in and enhancing that skill is very valuable tool to have. I work, of course, with clients in psychotherapy, helping them to increase that skill if they're open to it. Some people don't want to do it.
Yeah.
They're a little nervous about that. But, you know, if people have ever been in a crisis situation, as an example, walking down the street and suddenly there's something telling you something's not right, it's really important to pay attention to that.
Exactly. Or that person in your life that you know, but you've always got that weird feeling about, you know, things like that. Pay attention. Your gut is telling you that for a reason. I know there's some limited, I know there's some research on gut and things like that, and it shows most of the time your gut is right.
Oh yes.
And so it's, I think that's something that needs to be developed more in people. Like, I'm glad you're doing that with your clients because, a good gut can make a big difference in someone's life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So why forensic medicine? What, in fact, why not explain to listeners what that involves?
Sure. I think when people hear forensic medical examiner, they think, oh, this guy does autopsies. And that's not me. I have consults for homicides, but I strictly work with the living. And so I don't do autopsies. I don't have a morgue I go to, nothing like that. So that's my job. And basically, we're one of the few teams in the state, even the country, that will conduct forensic medical exams for patients of all ages. So from birth until death, cradle to grave. So it could be a child who's injured, who's being physically or sexually abused. It could be an adult, domestic violence, strangulation, human trafficking, elder abuse. You know, we're able to do that full spectrum from the start of life to the end of life.
On the living.
On the living, yes.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's a good differentiation because I think oftentimes, like you say, a medical examiner, people go, oh,
yeah.
Autopsy. Yes, yes. So is that the full focus of what you do, or do you also see patients as a doctor?
So I used to have a robust, dedicated panel of pediatric patients when I was doing general peds at Shasta Community Health Center. But the forensic world, there's just so much need out there. And credit my boss, CEO of the Shasta Community Health Center, Dean Germano, and the board, who have been incredibly supportive of this job. And so a couple of years ago, they decided to make me full-time forensics because it was just interfering too much with my ability to provide primary care. And so, I appreciate them. And so then I actually moved, and now my primary office is at the Children's Legacy Center. And I'm also a founding member of that. So that's where we conduct most of our child abuse exams and where interviews take place. And so that has also been an incredible place to work. And I'm one of the founding members. And so to watch this grow over the last, more than half of a decade into, just the pillar that it is today. And credit, Kimberly Johnson, the CEO, right, and the board, too, of doing an amazing job building this up as a pillar in our community. And so that's actually where my office is. And so I do maintain a very, very, very small primary care panel. But I always tell people when I testify in court, I tell people that's the favorite part of my job, right, is the pediatrics. I mean, who doesn't want to see
kids,
a four-month-old who's like healthy and the family's blossoming? But I have an extremely small panel of patients. And so I do miss primary care a lot, but I've always lived by the philosophy I go where I'm needed.
Yes.
And I really do. Like if somebody came to town and said, hey, Dr. D, I want to do call, I want to see all these consults, I'd be like, be my guest, go for it. You get up at 4 a.m., right?
Mm-hmm.
this isn't a competition. I'm just doing this because it's needed.
Needed, yeah.
And so that's kind of what led me into forensics, actually, was that sort of filling this gap that was needed.
So you didn't plan it. It just kind of evolved.
I did not plan it, no. In fact, you know, my wife remembers a conversation. I don't, of course, now because of all the information I have to take in all the time. But talking about, I think it was talking about child abuse or something like that. And never, and this is like way back in the day, right? Never saw myself doing that, yada, yada. I don't know. I made some comment like that. But clearly, that wasn't the case. But you don't know what you don't know.
Yes, really, really. So perhaps there's someone listening that doesn't understand or know what the Children's Legacy Center is and what it does. Can you give a description of that?
Sure. So the model itself has been around since the 80s. So it's actually not something we invented. It's not a novel idea. In fact, there's, I think, 700 plus around the world now. But what it is it's a place where a child can be interviewed and have that interview recorded and be watched by everybody involved in the process that needs to watch that interview. So, for example, a child's brought in for something bad that happens to them, and they are asked questions by what's called a forensic interviewer, which uses a standardized technique to give questions. This is a evidence-based, generally accepted across the entire world way to interview children. And so the interview takes place. You might have someone from law enforcement, from, you know, children's services, from the DA's office, a medical provider like me, that'll be watching this interview. And that way that child doesn't have to repeat that story to each of us individually.
Yes.
And then afterwards, they can get a medical exam. So again, they can kind of just do everything at once rather than separate. Because prior to the Children's Legacy Center, that's what happened. You know, the kid had to go to multiple providers and repeat that story. And that's a very traumatizing process for a child. And so,
or for anyone, really.
Yeah, for an adult too. Exactly. Yes. And so this really mitigated the trauma of the process, if you will.
Yes.
And so that's what the Legacy Center does.
And you're one of the founding members.
Yes. Yep.
And is there just one location for that, or are there multiple locations now?
There's multiple locations because it's really grown and it's an amazing organization. But the main interview center is one place, and that's where the medical exams take place. But there's other services
that
now. That's actually on 110 Shasta. So as you're coming off the 44 into downtown, which I think is probably the biggest feeder into downtown.
Yes.
That very first blue building on your right, you'll see the Shasta Health Center logo, and you'll see some of the other logos from the other MDT members, multidisciplinary team. That's where it takes place.
I see. Now, when the child requires a medical exam, do you do that?
Yes.
Okay. And then with that, you look from a forensic perspective as well as a medical. I mean, it's one and the same, but you're specialized in the forensics.
Correct.
So, so when you specialize in forensics, how does that change you? How are you different from a doctor that hasn't had that expertise?
It's a great question. So forensic care is medical care, much like, you know, you have other forms of care. And I'll give an example, and then I'll explain more too. Say you have a patient that presents to an ER and has a skin lesion. The physician looks at the skin lesion, does a detailed history, takes photographs, and send swabs to a lab. Can you tell me if that's a wound care doctor or a forensic doctor?
Mm-hmm.
You can't,
yeah.
Right? Both do the same thing. Wound care takes photos because they want to measure the lesion and make sure they follow it. Wound care takes swabs and sends it to a lab to analyze for DNA, right? Or the RNA of the bacteria. It's no different than a forensic provider who sees a bruise or sees some other skin lesion, takes photographs, swaps it for DNA, and sends it off to a crime lab, right? So it's the same thing. And I think that's what also people don't realize is that forensic medicine is medicine, right? At the end of the day, I'm just a doctor, right? Mm-hmm. I work for the patient. I'm employed by the hospital or the clinic, right? And so that's kind of the basics. But what the difference is that, and what most people don't understand is that there is almost no forensic medical care training in basic medical school,
really,
residency, nursing school, or NPPA. It almost doesn't exist. Especially when it comes to adult forensic medicine. Yeah, it is unbelievable. When people find out, they're in shock. And I encourage you, if you're listening out there, go and ask your nursing colleagues. Go and ask your friends or your physician friends. Like, how many courses did you get dedicated to domestic violence or child abuse? Did you do 6 weeks of training in your medical school? Did you do 8 weeks? And most of them will tell you none, and they didn't even have a lecture. The difference being the people up here, because I educate the residents a lot up here, and we educate some of the nursing staff up here. So they do have more. Like, they have way more education on this than I ever got. in my education. And it's something I actually want to change. I have, again, there are so few of us that do domestic violence in the country that I'm like putting together. It's almost like an Avengers kind of moment, right? Where I've got a doc, the three docs here. I've got a doc in Vegas who doesn't do exactly what I do. Doesn't do the forensic medical component, but does recognize the brain injury from domestic violence. A Canadian neurosurgeon. This is how far I'm going. And then the other one I found is in New York. New York has the only ER physician forensic fellowship in the country. Wow. That's how few of us do this work. And I think it would be amazing at the end of my life or career in 25 years, I would like to have standardized forensic medical courses for medical schools, nursing schools, PA schools, NP schools, etc. And that's because sexual violence affects more than half of women in this country, and domestic violence affects 2 out of 5 women. Let's compare that to something that affects women. Number one killer of women is heart disease. And if you look at the articles, or if you look at the research on heart disease, you can have a woman who has no risk factors. Her chance of getting heart disease by the time she's 80 is only 1 in 15. If she has 2 or more risk factors, smoking, drinking, diabetes, hypertension, it's still only 1 out of 5. So violence affects twice as many women as cardiovascular disease, the number one killer. Yet how many lectures? Violence. Violence affects more of our patients than most medical conditions.
For women.
For women especially, yes. And yet how many lectures did I get on domestic violence in medical school residency? Zero.
That's kind of staggering.
What was the first lecture you think I got in medical school? I'll give you one guess.
Let's see. The human body. The heart.
Cardiovascular disease. Why? Because it affects more patients than most other diseases, and it's serious. Violence has just been completely left off the table. I mean, and there's articles that talk about this too, how medicine has just turned a blind eye to this, despite it being so common. I mean, the fact that there's less than 5 physicians in California that specialize in this.
Yes.
A 40 million population state. I mean, that tells you something. It's why I've been, you know, had to go to testify in other parts of the state, in Southern California, because they don't have any experts. Don't believe me? Go to the LA courts. So if you go to Los Angeles courts and you click their expert panel, they list what they have proved as expert panels. If you go to the child abuse section, there's a plethora of physicians. When you go to domestic violence, there's no physicians, no nurses, there's one psychiatrist. This is Los Angeles, right? Population 15 million.
Yes.
And they have no physicians that specialize in domestic violence. That's what I'm saying. When I say we have the most advanced program in the state, we literally have the most advanced program in the state up here.
Wow.
It's just, there's so much out there. If the general public knew what was actually happening behind the scenes in the medical world, I think there would be more awareness, and I think there'd be some change. Because again, at the end of the day, it's just, I'm providing medical care, but I'm doing it in a specialized way, just like a stroke doctor does it in a specialized way, right? Or a heart doctor does it, you know. But my specialty is, by and large, it's amazing. It's so dichotomous because there are so few of us. We're probably the smallest medical specialty, yet this condition affects more patients than just about every other specialty. It's incredible when you think of it that way, the dichotomy. And it's out there, right? I mean, like I said, I'm proof of it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's something that does need to change. And so, hey, if somebody listening has a connection with medical school curriculum directors, ACGME or LME, you know, let me know. Reach out. I'm not hard to find.
This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in cooperation and collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. We have in the studio today Dr. Sean Dugan. He is adult and pediatric forensic medical examiner, the director of forensic services at Shasta Community Health Center. You know, I never realized, you might say, the condition or the status of how things are with forensic medicine. Yep. So was it just by exposure that you developed the training?
Yeah, well, it was a case, actually. excuse me, it was a case. So after I started working here, about 2 years in, I had a nurse, I had a scribe, and I was going toe-to-toe with another urgent care doc for being the most productive in the health center. So I love to see patients. I love to see work-ins. I love the speed. It just, the challenge of it, it just was just jiving with me. And it wasn't that I was spending a little bit of time in the room. What I was doing was I was spending a lot of time in the room, but I was maximizing my time outside of the room. So my nurse and scribe were like my left and right hand. And mm-hmm. so I got through my charts quickly. I put my orders in quickly. You know, I wasn't staying late to donuts either. I was just done. And that's because I, you know, I, as a leader, I built my team up. And, I, you know, like I said, it was like a symbiotic relationship almost, you know, that, you know, they were almost an extension of my mind, right?
Yes.
My scribes knew what to write, when to write it, how to write it. My nurse knew the orders I was going to order, you know, et cetera. So we just worked together well. And so there was a day in 2014 when I was taking work-ins and one of my colleagues had called out sick. And so I got a nurse came up to my station and she said, hey, I got this hospital follow-up. You know, her doc called out sick. She really needs to be seen. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll see her, no problem. And so I started reading the chart and it became immediately obvious to me that this was child abuse. I mean, it was like obviously child abuse. And even though I had only a little bit of training, we had some training. I mean, I had a little bit of child abuse, nothing on domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
But even with that, I could tell, like, this is obviously child abuse. And this child had been seen at two different hospitals, and it just got completely missed.
Wow.
And so we initiated the referral, you know, went through that whole process. And at the end of it, what ended up happening was that I was told at the time that, hey, you know what, like the medical providers have really not done a good job on this case. And so that's when I realized, when I had community members telling me this, that's when I realized that, you know, there needs to be somebody doing this work. And at that time, the closest center was down in Sacramento, right? Uh-huh. Which is still like pretty far, 2.5 hours. And so I started doing additional training. I ended up, you know, doing physical child abuse. And then I took over the pediatric sexual child abuse program at that time. And at that time, there was nobody on call. So kids just had to be seen the next business day. And so I immediately put myself on call 24/7. And this is without any pay. I didn't do this for the money. In fact, I'm probably the only physician in California that did call, you know, as long as I did it for without pay. But I did it because it was needed. Again, I go where I'm needed. That's my philosophy in life. And over time, I started to work in cooperation with the adult sexual assault program here. And they were having some staffing issues because, you know, burnout, things like that.
Yes.
And so I started doing adult exams. And then I started quickly realized like, hey, this exam I'm doing on this 48-year-old female is the same exam I'm doing on a 16-year-old female, right? Like, why are we not doing this for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
My license in California is a physician and surgeon. There is no age limit. And so we evolved and became a full forensic care team, which is providing services to adults. And of course, then our caseload exploded.
Yeah, I imagine.
You know, basically doubled our caseload because we were seeing adults and kids. And so that's kind of how we got here. And then funny story is in 2019, I was notified by, at the time, the director of One Safe Place about a strangulation training. And I had like 2 days to sign up. It was almost the deadline. And so I signed myself up. I paid my own way. I took vacation. And I went down to Fort Worth. And I went with that same executive director of One Safe Place. And I went with a physician colleague of mine who is still on, who was one of the physicians I work with at a strangulation clinic. And we went with another DA investigator. And we got back on a Friday. And I kid you not, this is an absolutely true story. That following Friday, we opened the first strangulation TBI clinic in California.
Wow.
1 week.
That's impressive.
Yeah. We were able to do it because I had time blocked in my schedule for the child abuse work I was doing. So, bam. 1 week later, 3 patients right out of the gate, we saw for strangulation. Wow. And just never looked back.
Couple questions I have for you. You talked about previous to your willingness to be on call, there was no one on call. What's the significance of being available for call?
Significance is timing to collect, you know, to take photographs and render that medical care for the patient. And also, you know, for a lot of patients, if somebody's not willing to see them when they present, the chance they're going to follow up later starts to diminish significantly.
Certainly.
Yeah. And I don't blame them, right? Like, it's part of the trauma process. Do you want to go back to the hospital later or the clinic to get seen again? for a very traumatic thing that happened to you and usually involving a very sensitive part of your body. Like,
yes.
There's a logic behind that I understand.
Yes. And, you know, just if a sexual assault, you know, a person is going to want to take a shower, clean themselves. So waiting till the next day.
Right.
That in itself, I would think, would be another traumatic event.
Very traumatic. And it happens. I mean, there are articles if somebody wants to email me, I will give them to you freely, about other centers in California where patients are basically waiting for hours, not able to pee, or told like, hey, you could pee, but you might lose valuable evidence, as they say.
Oh, gosh.
Not drink, not eat, etc. It's abhorrent. And it goes down to the root of there's no education, virtually none, for physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, in medical school, nursing school, NPPA school, etc., and virtually none for adult sexual assault.
That really has to change.
It does. And I'm willing to work and do that. I just need to climb up the rungs to find the person, you know, and that's in charge that's able to do that, right? The ACGME is what really accredits residencies. There's another one for medical schools, the BRN, Board of Registered Nursing, for nursing schools. If we can get to those people and say, hey, like, we have a curriculum, I will share it freely with you. We need to start implementing this change into all these schools because this is a medical condition that affects more patients than most other medical conditions, yet has the smallest pool of people who specialize in it.
Wow. Any thoughts about why that oversight exists?
It's
a stigma?
I think it's stigma. I think it's hard for people to want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And violence touches so many people in society that they may just kind of not want to.
And all levels of society. It's not just the poor or unemployed. It's definitely all segments of community.
Exactly.
When you think of Northern California compared to the rest of the state or the nation, I know the ACE scores here, it's Adverse Childhood Experiences scores, are the highest in California as well as in the nation, which deals with the impact of trauma throughout our childhood. Do you think there's... because of what goes on here with such things as trauma, that there's a more of a need that helped generate this specialization?
Yeah, we have a high rate of generational trauma here where trauma is just passed on from generation to generation. Our ACE scores are through the roof. Substance use is actually more common than not here in Reading, right? Like, substance use is more than 50%, according to that ACEs study in 2012. So technically it's normal, right, to have substance use at home if you define normal as most of us. And our child abuse substantiated rates are 3 times the state average. So if you I have data I could show you, but if you look at the trend since 2013, the rate in California has dropped from around 9 to 6, the general rate. But in Shasta County, it's nearly 20.
Wow.
It's triple. And it started spiking after the multidisciplinary team formed for the Children's Legacy Center and after the work I started doing in child abuse, right? It just starts spiking up. And so, you know, it's a side effect, if you will, a byproduct of having those services available,
yes,
you know, to the community. But I think it just really boils down to our the generational trauma that's just prolific in our community.
And, you know, in California, has the largest Native American population in the U.S. And so that's certainly a culture of trauma and multi-generational trauma. So you're not only dealing with trauma that exists in their lives personally, but generations before have experienced trauma. So when I'm working with someone that's Native American, I always try to educate them about the role of that. Because like with the adverse childhood experiences scores, it tells you that intervention is needed if you want to change the health and well-being of the individual.
Yes.
So anyone can go online and there's a form you can download. It's only 10 questions. You fill it out honestly and take your score. And, you know, the thought is if you have 4 or higher, definitely get into some sort of intervention, which is usually psychotherapy.
Yes, exactly. And those interventions have been proven to, you know, mitigate or treat that trauma. Some of the most successful people I know have a high ACE score of 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't know it just by talking to them, you know, meeting them day to day. But that's because they were able to break the trauma cycle, got the help they needed. And their kids will never experience, you know, those horrible experiences they grew up with. And I think it's important for the public to know that you know, the toxic stress that you undergo as a child and then as an adult, it literally changes the structures in your brain. It will actually make certain structures smaller. And the reason that happens is it turns out that these traumatization of the brain and these hormones actually affect the expression of your DNA. And what specifically happens is they downregulate, or they turn off or turn down the white matter, the melanin, right? The coating, mm-hmm. the myelin, the coating of your neurons. And so it will literally change the structure of your brain by affecting the expression of your DNA. Now imagine that affects your brain. You raise your child, and maybe unfortunately in a traumatic situation, it happens to their brain, it happens to the next generation, next generation, right? And so you just pass this along until somebody gets intervention and it stops. And let's say you grew up with childhood trauma. You're not incurable. You can get the help. Yes. And you can be, you know, you can heal.
And right? It doesn't take years anymore.
No. And I'm going to quote Galina. She is a survivor, and we were part of a documentary released in October called Swim Again. And this was in partnership with the CDC and the California District Attorney Association. And Galina starts off the whole thing, the whole episodes. There's five of them. And I'm very humble and feel fortunate to be the physician in those featured in those episodes. But Galina starts off with talking about how, you know, experiencing these horrible events as a, you know, child or as an adult, it's like losing your arm. And imagine you lost your arm while you're swimming. You can either focus on what's lost, the fact that you don't have an arm anymore, or you can learn to swim again, right? You can learn to swim again and focus on what you still have, right? And so it's a powerful analogy, and I have full credit to her for she came up with it as a survivor. And I think it's a great analogy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than focusing on what happened to you and those losses, focus on what you have. And again, learn to swim again, right?
You know, I like the emphasis you point out about the impact on the brain, because the brain is the command center for the body. And behaviors, thoughts, all those things, the cascade. What's really important is that people realize today, it used to take years in psychotherapy because it was all talk therapy. Today we have eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. We have what's called brain spotting. We have neurofeedback. Those all specifically work with the brain to help it recover from the trauma so that you can hopefully return it to the healthy state. And that, you know, it doesn't take forever.
No, it doesn't. I've known some human trafficking survivors that swear by EMDR,
yes.
The eye movement. One in particular, I remember she told me it was like a light switch. It was just, she went from, you know, kind of this always being on her mind to finally like being able to relax. She's like, for the first time in my life, I felt like I could actually relax.
Yes. Because what's interesting about EMDR, the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, the brain is thought of as holding the energy of the trauma. And through that process, it's an organic process. It gets the brain to release that. And so that's why it's like a light switch. All of a sudden, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's very, very powerful. And it doesn't have to take a lifetime to go through it. This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. We are here in conversation with a member of the Shasta Community Health Center, Dr. Sean Dugan. He is the adult and pediatric forensic medical examiner, director of forensic services. Got to keep that going. And I think that one of the points you made at the beginning of the program, that doesn't mean you're examining dead bodies.
No.
You work with what age groups?
Birth until death, cradle to grave.
And so you have cases that involve sexual assault, domestic violence,
child abuse, child sexual assault, human trafficking, elder abuse. Yep.
The whole spectrum. So when you get a call, your office is on Shasta Street.
Yes.
As you enter Reading off of 44. And how often do you get a call, do you think?
Oh, it just varies. It's really feast or famine. And I mean, I've had days where I've done the whole spectrum, right? I remember one day I woke up, I had a pediatric physical child abuse case. And then I had a urgent child sexual assault case. I remember afterwards, I got home and I literally just entered the door, phone goes off, and now I have a domestic violence human trafficking case.
Wow.
And then I had another case later that night. And so I've seen the full spectrum in a day. And that's just how it is in forensic medicine. Or I might go a few days and not get a call. So it really just depends. It's just feast or famine, I guess.
Wow.
And that's the thing about this job that creates a lot of stress for people in this field, is that you always have to be on. Like, you always mm-hmm. have to be ready. You know, kind of, it's kind of like Batman, right? Like, you're ready to go at the call, you know? And I think, more stressful part of this job for most people, is having to always be ready, if that makes sense.
Now, you said there were three in Reading. Is that your team?
Oh, so there's three of us physicians, but there's uh-huh. multiple nurses too that work with us.
Ah.
And in total in Reading, we have 5 sites, which is actually amazing, because there are several counties, especially in Southern California or even Northern California, like, we're in Northern, but you know, yeah. the Sacramento Mid. Area. Yeah. And they have one team for
wow.
a county of like 1 to 2 million people in the one location. And so, again, Shasta is unique in that we have 5 different locations. Now, each site doesn't, you know, each site has a different function.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, we have 5 total sites in this county. And we work with our partnering agencies, our, you know, partnering medical providers closely in Siskiyou, Lassen, and Tehama. And I work with some of the other medical providers in the other counties, but those are the 3 other counties that we really have shored up a relationship with. Modoc, we used to have an examiner out there, and she moved. But there's another examiner that I've trained that will probably start doing call up there too, or
Excellent.
Taking cases.
Yes.
And so we'll be able to bring them back in the fold too.
So the other 2 medical providers, are they specialized in forensics?
Uh-huh. Yes. They okay. primarily deal with, they've been taught for everything, but they uh-huh. primarily focus on domestic violence in terms of strangulation and head injury and traumatic brain injury. That's their primary focus right now.
So you did mention before a strangulation clinic. So what are we talking about with that? What is that? It's kind of like a very focused, more so than, I mean, you have domestic violence, you have sexual assault, and you have strangulation. Why did that develop?
Well, most of domestic violence involves brain injury. So 2 out of 5 women, 1 out of 5 men will experience intimate partner violence at some point in their lives. We know from the literature about half are strangled. This specific to the women, half of them are strangled, and it's up to 90% suffer a blow to the head at some point during this, you know, violent relationship. And so what the literature also shows us is about 75%, 3/4 of women who experience domestic violence experience a one-time brain injury, and 50% receive repetitive brain injury. So brain injury is common. And let's just do some quick math, right? Half the U.S. population is female approximately, right?
Mm-hmm.
2/5 of that is going to experience lifetime violence, and 3/4 of that is going to experience an injury to the brain. A significant portion of women and men in American society suffer brain injuries as a result of intimate partner violence, right? It's prolific in our society. And so that's a big focus of our clinic, is conducting the strangulation, you know, forensic medical exam, assessing for head injury, and then screening, or in the case of a physician, diagnosing these patients with a traumatic brain injury. It is so common. I mean, the lion's share, you're talking a small fraction of patients that we see don't have a brain injury. That's how common this is. And a brain injury can be, you know, from a blow to the head that, you know, renders you dizzy, or you see black, or go unconscious, or it could be someone strangling you to the point of unconsciousness. And again, it's just so common in our society that we see that volume of patients at one safe place. And, you know, usually we're running like with a wait list, right? Because there's only so many hours in the day, and these mm-hmm. exams take a long time. For the patient portion, it's about 1.5 to 2 hours, but then I have to write my detailed note, and that can take another 2 to 4 hours. And so yeah. these are very detailed exams. Our notes are typically, you know, 14 pages, 10 to 14 pages long, sometimes longer. I had a trafficking patient once. I did a 19-page report. I mean, that's how detailed it was.
Wow.
And so...
why so detailed?
Because we go through all the events, screening for that brain injury and screening for that strangulation. And so usually it's rare in domestic violence for the person to leave after the first incident. it's very common that it takes 7-10 times, right? And so, I mean, I've had patients that describe hundreds of times that they're strangled, hundreds of times that they've been hit in the head. And they tend to have these severe, prolonged, if not lifelong, memory problems as a result of the brain damage that they sustained.
You know, I think most people can understand that if a person has a blow to the head or knocked unconscious, that they have a brain injury. Why strangulation? You know, how does a brain injury occur from strangulation?
So it's amazing because there's been so much research in this field. There's even a human trial that was done in the 40s on strangulation. And it's a very detailed, meticulous, well-done study. It's one of the only human trials we have in all forensic medicine.
Wow.
But what it turns out is that all of us, whether you're in a volunteer for a study, whether you're a police officer, or whether you're an MMA fighter, because that's where they've studied these, all of us go down within 5 to 10 seconds during strangulation if there's no blood flow to your brain. So if forces applied to your neck and the blood vessels that feed your brain are compressed and can't deliver blood, we all lose consciousness in 5 to 10 seconds. It's amazing because no matter how smart you are, how talented, our differences in personalities, how creative you are, it matters not when it comes to our brain. All of our brains are bound by the same basic limitations in oxygen physiology, meaning we can only go without oxygen for 5 to 10 seconds before our brain shut down. And when you lose consciousness from strangulation, you are getting brain damage, specifically to the memory-forming centers in your brain, which is why when you wake up, you may not even remember you lost consciousness,
mm-hmm.
right? Those memories might be gone. And that day going forward, you will often have a really hard time remembering new events, conversations, and then your working memory, which is your short-term memory. So keeping stuff in your brain while you're doing something else. Those will often, the patients will suffer with those memory deficits for a long time, if not lifelong.
It's staggering to think of what's going on in our community. And I'm grateful that we have this team that's here and that kind of you're at the pioneer of the field developing. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, we have any day now. So I'm waiting to hear back and on a study that we submitted to a major medical journal.
Wow.
This will be the first study in the world to publish a strangulation assessment form that's physician developed, which is our form. And this will also be the first study to look at the rate that a patient who loses consciousness during strangulation doesn't remember it. And this is unpublished data, obviously it hasn't been published yet, but mm-hmm. our data shows half of our patients had a gap in memory.
Wow.
Where they lost consciousness, but they didn't remember it. Yeah. And that can happen. And the reason that happens is when you wake up, your brain will put two and two together, right? It'll kind of fold the time over. And so when you ask that person, did you lose consciousness? They'll say no. But when you ask them, was there a gap in memory? And they replay that memory, half the time they say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating.
It is really cool research. And I hope it gets accepted.
Yes.
It's been a while since they got the reviews back. So I think that's a good sign. But hey, you know what? If this journal doesn't take it, we'll send it somewhere else. Not
yes.
a big deal.
Good. Keep after it.
Yeah.
It's, I think, an important work. Now, your strangulation clinic serves just Shasta County?
So no, we serve anybody who comes in. So the crazy part about California is because there's so few physicians and nurses that do this work, we have patients drive from the big cities to see us up here. So I had a patient recently that drove 4 hours from a major metropolitan area, I won't say which city, but a major, major city in California, and came up here for an exam because there's no one in the cities that is doing this type of work. Again, I cannot stress that how advanced our program is for the rest of the state. And so we will see patients from primarily this area and the surrounding counties, so 7 counties total. Less patients are coming from Tehama now and Siskiyou because they're being seen there. But and credit to those two nurses who are just, you know, amazing and pioneers in their field. Because, again, they're some of the first nurses to do this work, too.
Wow.
And so, but yeah, we'll see mostly from this area. But I have had several patients from the big cities come up to see us. And they find out about us because of their advocate or because of somebody else on the multidisciplinary team that says, hey, I went to a training. I know this guy. You know, you may have a brain injury. You should probably go see him and get your diagnosis.
So it can be done anytime after a crime or incident.
Correct. We typically do it within the first year. Have had some 5 years out because they have recurring symptoms of their traumatic brain injury. I had one that was more than 20 years out. So
wow.
Typically we focus on the, you know, most of our lion's share within the first year. But sometimes we have them go out further.
Once there's a brain injury, can anything be done?
Yes. So just like how we talked about with trauma.
EMDR.
EMDR, there is. And it's called occupational therapy. And if you can't tell by now, I love the brain and I love the science of the brain and memory. But what the occupational therapy does is it trains your brain to use existing alternate pathways to remember things that you're not able to remember. So if I could give an example, I had a patient who was strangled multiple times and she had really bad memory problems afterwards. Like she just could not remember stuff. But the biggest impact it was having on her life was remembering to make meals for herself and her son. So she would forget entire meals. That's how bad her memory was.
Wow.
And so what the occupational therapist did was went into the home and for several weeks, they trained her brain to automatically reach for what she needed. So for example, at the countertop level, everything she needed for a daily meal, like a sandwich after school or lunch on a weekend, whatever, everything that she needed for a daily meal was at the countertop level. Now, if it was a more special meal, like a Friday night dinner with her son or, you know, a date, everything for those like, you know, nicer meals was at the above the cabinet level. So it was in that, you know, the shelves above it.
Yes.
Now, if it's a really special meal like Christmas, Thanksgiving, birthdays, everything she needed was at the top level. So what's amazing is she trained her brain to just automatically reach for it and not have to think about where it was. It's the same type of memory. It's called spatial memory that allows you to ride a bike after not riding one for 5 years or play the piano or type.
Or drive,
et cetera. Like you don't even have to remember the first time you drove or ride your bike. You just do it automatically. So now when she needs to make a meal, she automatically reaches for the tools that she needs and the food that she needs. She doesn't think about it. It's amazing. And spatial memory is in the back of our brain, in the cerebellum. And it's one of the most oxygen resistant parts of our brain. So it is, you know, most of the time for our patients, they don't have spatial memory problems because that part of our brain is set up differently and it's more resistant.
Fascinating. We are here in conversation with Dr. Sean Dugan. He is the Adult and Pediatric Forensic Medical Examiner, Director of Forensic Services at Shasta Community Health Center. This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. This is just a fascinating topic, and I think what's important too, you know, you're talking about the occupational therapist helping people help their brain, body, that connection, relearn. If someone's out there and they have had an injury and they want to do something different, the encouragement is go to the physician, see what can be done, go to an occupational therapist. I know I broke my leg over a year ago and I had to learn, my leg had to learn to walk again. And the balance, I'm still working with balance because you have to retrain the brain leg thing.
Yep.
Who would
yep.
think?
Yep.
When they said I'd learned to walk again, I went, what? But it we kind of take for granted the capacity we have once we grow up and learn all these things that we can lose it because of injury.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Exactly.
I think it's important when I have a new client come in, the first thing I ask them on the intake, have you ever had a brain injury? Because if they had a brain injury, I know that that impacts them today.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. It does.
Yes. Your seven counties that you serve, do you go out to them or do they come to you? How's that work?
So typically they come to me for the patients, but I have seen patients in Siskiyou County and in Tehama in the hospitals, our sister hospitals. And I testify a lot in court. And so I go to Humboldt, you know, I drive up to Modoc. I even went down to Napa recently to testify down there. And so, we will typically, in those cases, I'll have to drive and go to different places. So,
yes.
I mean, I was just testifying here this week in Shasta. It's pretty common and was recently in Siskiyou for a trial. So, and I have one coming up in Tehama. So and when it comes to court, then that's when I travel or my team has to travel to those different areas.
So why would you be called to court? Give us kind of the background for that.
Sure. So if I see a patient, Because I'm a mandated medical reporter, I send my report to law enforcement, and then they do whatever they do from there. And so usually 1 to 2 years later, but sometimes it happens sooner, if the case ends up in court, then I'll get a subpoena. And because I saw the patient, I'm required by law to show up. So I have to show up. Like, yes. I could actually be in trouble if I didn't. Legal trouble.
Yes.
It's actually a crime if I don't. And so I show up to those cases and I offer what I saw, and I also offer an expert opinion because I'm a forensic medical expert. And then other times I get a subpoena for a patient I haven't seen, but they're requesting me to come in to provide expert testimony to, you know, either educate a judge, a jury, whoever, you know, about, and the attorneys, right? The prosecution, defense get educated about the, you know, effects of strangulation or child abuse, et cetera. Most of the time, if I'm doing expert testimony and I haven't seen the patient, it's strangulation. And that's just, again, because there's so few of us that do this work.
Yes.
You know, I've had people reach out from other states. I had a consult recently reach out from Florida. I mean, I can only be in so many places so many times. Yes. So I try to, you know, I do manage my time, say, yeah, I'm available, or no, I'm not available, I'm sorry, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so that's kind of how it works.
You kind of, ended up doing something you didn't really expect to do.
God knows I did not expect that I would do this. Yeah, yeah.
Do you find it fulfilling?
I love it. Yeah. Uh-huh. I love the work. The science behind it fascinates me, and it's complicated and it's complex. So it keeps me interested. And so, I really do like this work. I mean, I miss primary care. I genuinely mm-hmm. miss primary care. Primary care was very fulfilling for me. But until, you know, a busload of people who specialize in this, you know, forensic yeah. medicine
show up
in Reading, I'll keep doing this. But, you know, hey, if the busload showed up and they wanted to take it over, I'd say, all right, I'll go back to primary care. I mean, that's probably not realistic. I'm sure I get swept up by some other town or something like that, or other state. But, yeah, I really genuinely love this work, and it's just the science behind it fascinates my brain so much. Mm-hmm. I like memory. I like the brain. I like the complexity of that part of forensic medicine. So,
and that brain-body connection and how mm-hmm. to resolve issues if possible. And
yeah, and then there's more and more research coming out every year. Right?
Yes.
And it's and in the last 2 years, there have been two really big articles that show that even compared to other forms of violence, like a blow to the head, the strangulation patients perform way worse on the memory scales. I mean,
wow.
Like just absolutely poor and abysmal. So there is something unique about strangulation that sets it apart from other forms of trauma, like head injury or sexual assault. And that's because, again, you're literally killing brain cells when you lose consciousness.
I don't think people realize that, you know, like you said, how long does it take to shut off the blood flow before someone passes out?
5 to 10 seconds.
Five to 10 seconds. Exactly. Which is different than murdering them, because it takes longer to...
It only takes 1 to 2 minutes yeah. of strangulation to kill someone. Yeah, yeah. It's really not much time. Mm-mm. And I tell people, strangulation is a life-threatening event because something has to change or that person dies in 1 to 2 minutes, right? If you're compressing the neck hard enough to, you know, stop blood flow to the brain, if... whatever's causing that force doesn't stop, you die in 1 to 2 minutes. So it is a life-threatening condition, whether it's a few seconds or a minute or two, right? Something has to change or you're going to die.
For strangulation, to educate larger community, is there any sort of material you recommend if someone wants to look at what's going on and prevention, or help them respond if something occurs to be seen, or to change their life circumstances? As you stated before, domestic violence 7 to 10 times before someone actually leaves the situation. That's what research tells us. Is there anything out there that you can recommend to our listeners that here's something for you to review that might help you understand what's going on?
Yeah, so I'm a faculty member for the Training Institute on Strangulation Prevention. So if you look up Training Institute on Strangulation Prevention, it's also with the Alliance for Hope, and there is a ton of education on that website about strangulation, the effects of it, and it's from a multiple view approach. Like, there's an advocacy piece, there's a medical piece, there's, you know, the legal piece, you know, that kind of thing. And we provide numerous trainings both online and across the country. I'm doing trainings all the time too. I'd love to train one part of my job I love is I love to teach. I just do. I don't know. I just love it. And so we're constantly doing trainings here in the North State on strangulation. And but yeah, you don't have to go very far or wait very long. There's a plethora of resources out there, and the online resources on the Training Institute's website is robust, and it is geared towards the public.
So it's called Training Institute
on Strangulation Prevention.
On Strangulation Prevention. And the other one is the Alliance for Hope.
Yep. Yep. Okay. They're both the same. Yep.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Alliance for Hope's like the umbrella. Yeah.
I see. So that's good information for people to be able to tune into right at their fingertips.
Yeah.
And the encouragement, if someone's been in a situation where they've had a brain injury or strangled and they haven't been seen for that.
Yep. They can call One Safe Place if it's a, you know, domestic violence type situation. I mean, obviously call 911, you know, that whole thing, but
yes,
if they, if that part of it's over and they want to be seen, yeah, they can call One Safe Place and see if they can get in with the strangulation clinic, which we have at One Safe Place. There's a few exceptions though. So in California, there is no standardized forensic form for interpersonal violence when it comes to like non-domestic violence. So meaning like neighbor on neighbor. And so we will see those patients not usually at One Safe Place, but at Shasta Community. But short of that, yeah, majority of it's going to be domestic violence, so you can be seen at One Safe Place.
So One Safe Place is in Reading.
Yes.
And if someone needs to call and see about services, the phone number is 530-244-0117. That's 530-244-0117. They're on Benton Drive, beautiful facility, and they do very remarkable work, just like Children's Legacy Center.
Yes.
Amazing work. Great, great service to our community. Changes lives. So if someone wants to get in touch with you, do you have an email, phone number? Do they just call Shasta Community Health Center? What do you recommend?
Yeah, easiest thing to do is call the Children's Legacy Center or Shasta Community Health Center. You know, if they need to reach out to me, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. And if I'm not in town because I'm training or doing something else, then my nurse usually takes the message, and then she'll get it to me, you know, when I get back or if I'm on vacation. So yeah, absolutely, man. Especially if somebody out there has a connection to I really want to change the big picture, right, which is educating more people in the medical field and having more people available to provide this medical care. I mean, it's kind of like when, you know, before stroke hospitals came out, right? Like,
yes,
there was a few people that specialized in stroke, which is a form of anoxic brain injury,
yes,
which is the same as strangulation. And then some, you know, people got together and then they started, you know, putting this out there. And now, you know, most hospitals have a stroke program. Well, it's analogous to what we want to do now. We're kind of in that point in time where we need to get this out there so that more patients can receive medical care. Because without that, there are a lot of patients who have traumatic brain injury, and their diagnosis is being missed.
Yes.
In primary care, in urgent care, in emergency care. And that is not any fault of the, you know, physicians or nurses that are seeing these patients. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And so if we can put this as a standardized form of our medical education, we're going to identify more patients with those injuries, make more referrals to occupational therapy or other, you know, or therapists, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we're going to help more people receive the medical care they need.
I really want to thank you for coming and sharing your knowledge. I'm going to have you come back.
Oh, I'd love to. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. I love your passion for neuroscience, the brain, because that's, for me, working with EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, watching people transform in front of you by doing an organic process is just like so exhilarating. So thank you for your service to our community. We've been in conversation here with Dr. Sean Dugan. He is the Adult and Pediatric Forensic Medical Examiner, the Director of Forensic Services at Shasta Community Health Center. And this is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I want to remind Dr. Dugan, myself, and our listeners, we want to make this day and every day a day to enjoy exceptional living. Thank you for joining us.